Let's start with conscience. What's the idea of a conscience? I think the idea is that there's something inside a person which tells him what is right and what is wrong. Of course, a person doesn't always follow it, but he knows what's right. And he knows what's right because his conscience tells him. Often we say, follow your conscience. Why would you tell a person to follow his conscience? Because his conscience tells him what's right. So a person is challenged for what he did. And he says, I was following my conscience. Often that ends the discussion. So what would you say to him? You shouldn't follow your conscience? A conscience is a kind of last appeal. Once the conscience says so, then the matter is settled. That's the way the idea is used. Now, I'm inclined to think that this idea is a myth. I'm inclined to think that there is no such thing in a person, in the person, which tells him what is right, and tells him without making mistakes, tells him infallibly. There may be something in you telling you this is right, but it might be mistaken. If so, it's not a conscience, because then I wouldn't tell a person, always follow your conscience. Wait a minute, wait a moment, maybe it's wrong. And if a person said, I did it because I was following my conscience, that wouldn't end the discussion. Let's see whether your conscience was right or wrong. I'm inclined to think that whatever's inside you, whatever voice you hear, could make mistakes. And therefore this idea of conscience, the idea of conscience that you should always follow it, that it's the end of all discussion, that it's got to be right, is a mistake. Let's see. Let's see how it works. Allied to this, and I will come to this as a second step, allied to this is whether a person can ever be shown to be wrong in his most fundamental decisions, what his fundamental values are, what his fundamental goals are, fundamental priorities are, whether it's possible to ever make, for a person to be shown to be making a mistake. It's all the same general topic. Well, let's try a case like this. A person faces a life situation and he's caught up in it and he has to make a decision. Let's say there are two alternatives, A and B. And his deep inner voice tells him A is right and B is wrong. So he does A. And years later, he comes to think that he made a mistake. Made a mistake. Really, B was right, and A was wrong. Now, can that happen? Has it happened? Right? I think everybody has had this experience, though I'll explore it a little bit, maybe it's not quite so simple, but on the surface, everybody's had this experience. As you grow older, you look back on what you decided earlier, and you see that it was immature, or poor thought processes, or lack of experience, whatever it is.
Your conscience changes.
Oh, so if so, the conscience can't be right both times. I'm not passing judgment now which time is correct, which time is incorrect, but it can't be right both times. One time the conscience said to pick A, the other time the conscience said to pick B.
But it's right at the given time.
No, but that's ridiculous, right? This is very important because I don't say A was right then and B is right now. What I say is I made a mistake. I feel guilty. I say I chose the wrong thing then. That's very important. I'm not saying it's a new situation. So let's go through this again. At one time, I'm faced with A and B. My conscience, so-called, my inner voice says to choose A, and I choose A. And later I think back on the first case. Not a new case. I think back on the first case. And I think that I made a mistake. So they can't both be right.
But could you say that the second time you're basing it on information you didn't have back then, so as you have new information, the decision could be different, even if it's the exact same case.
Right.
Okay, but then why would that not mean that it had made a mistake? Okay, this really is what I wanted to...
There would also be C in 5 years.
That's another problem. Okay, I'm not coming to that now. I'm not coming to that. That's another problem. Alright, let me go into his question, because he's asking a general question. When we decide that something is right or wrong, we're really basing that decision on two factors. Number one, the information we have about the situation. And number two, our values. Now sometimes, our judgment, what was right or wrong, concretely in that situation, changes because we get new information. Not because our values change, but just because our information changes. I saw Peter pull out a gun and shoot Paul down in cold blood. Peter's a murderer. Horrible. Terrible. Later I see a videotape of the thing, and I see that Paul had a knife. And Paul, in fact, pulled the knife first. Well, from my angle of vision, I couldn't see Paul's knife. All I saw was Peter pulling out the gun and shooting him down. So I said, oh, what a terrible thing. I condemned Peter. It was a mistake. Peter wasn't the criminal. Paul was the criminal. In that case, I've changed my judgment, but not because my values have changed, but because the information has changed. So here, everyone agrees that if you don't have the right information, your judgment could be mistaken in reality. That has nothing to do with the conscience making a mistake. I agree. But there are other kinds of changes where a person weighs one value more heavily than another value. And comes to feel later that it was a mistake. Not because he took into account reasons and discovered the reasons were wrong. Not because he based that on fact. It was his sense of how the world is set up. Its sense of importance. What's more important? My development of my individual abilities or my relationships and responsibilities to other people? Now, could be that at one time I'm more attracted to, I'm more in sympathy with the development of one's individual life, and another time I'm more in sympathy with one's responsibilities and relationships to other people. Not because I learned new facts about them. I just feel more that this is more weighty, that this is more important than the other. After all, what did the original judgment base itself on? It wasn't based on an argument. It wasn't based on information, evidence. It wasn't based on doing surveys and statistics. It was based on one sense of what's important. If that's what the person was based on, then that can spontaneously change as well. So I think there are changes of judgment as to what to do, what not to do, even without learning new facts about the case. I may mature in certain ways, but that just means my values have changed. With your maturing, sometimes your values change. But then if your values change, the idea that the conscience is an infallible inner voice is in trouble. Because at one time it tells me one thing, and another time it tells me another thing. Here's another example. Let's imagine two people who are considering the same case and have opposite inner voices. One inner voice says A is right, and one inner voice says B is right. Now, I have to be careful here. If I have two people, Peter and Paul, Peter's voice says A is right, and Paul's voice says B is right, it might be that A is right for Peter and B is right for Paul. So I have to avoid that. So here's my case. My case is Peter and Paul are partners in a business. And the business is undertaking a certain obligation, and there are difficulties. The question is, what should the business do? Now this is a decision in common that Peter and Paul have to make. Peter is deciding what Peter and Paul should do, and Paul is deciding what Peter and Paul should do. So the decisions are really about the very same issue. And Peter's inner voice says that we should do A, and Paul's inner voice says that we should do B. Again, I think at least one of them's got to be wrong. It might be C, that's also true. But at least one of them's got to be wrong. So here again, we can't credit that inner voice with the kind of infallibility that a conscience is supposed to have.
So business should have pitifying values, mission statement, and business should be a way.
Yeah, yeah, but in business, you'll know that there will always be new circumstances which are not clear according to the original statements. That's why law is changing all the time, because new situations occur. Yeah. So anyway, if a person can change, if a person's conscience can change, and if two people sincerely listening to their inner voices can have opposite judgments about what they should do, then the idea that that inner voice is infallible is in trouble. What is infallible? Clearly it's making mistakes. The same thing's true about a person's decisions of his ultimate values, his ultimate goals, his ultimate priorities. Many will tell you that those decisions can't be criticized. They're beyond all critique, because it's just deciding for myself what I most want to do, or think is most important to do. But even that's a mistake. Thomas Nagel has a couple of good arguments here. Let's suppose that someone has chosen A as a value. Let's suppose that you and I know that A is impossible. He doesn't know this. He thinks it's possible. But we know that it's impossible. Couldn't we say to one another, he's made a mistake. In choosing A, he's made a mistake. An impossible value is a mistake. Why is it a mistake? Because a value is something that's going to prompt you to act. Values, at least under certain circumstances, are things that guide your action. Investing action in trying to accomplish something which is impossible is a waste. So we know it's a mistake. This isn't so far-fetched, because even in this extreme case, people try to square the circle and try to trisect angles. They try to build machines that don't use up energy, perpetual mobility. Every editor of every scientific journal gets dozens of papers like this every year. And they all have one thing in common. The author of the paper doesn't know why it's impossible. That's if he knows and he has a theory of how to get around it. He's just unaware why it's impossible. And he spends all this time writing up this paper with footnotes and references and, you know, Gothic font and 14-point font. And he sends it into the journal, and the editor just throws it away and writes back and says, sorry, it's impossible. The guy wasted a lot of time because he's trying to do something that's impossible. So if I know that what he has dedicated himself to was impossible, then I can criticize his choice of that goal as an inappropriate choice. Much more common is where people have two or more goals and they conflict. Each goal is indeed possible, but the goals taken jointly are not possible. The person hasn't thought of considering how they work together. And the same critique applies. It's inappropriate for a person to have a set of goals if some contradict others, and so that the set of goals is not jointly realizable. My pet example of this is a great statement of contemporary Jewry who want, on the one hand, to promote Jewish continuity, and on the other hand, want to be part and parcel of Western culture without any segregation. They have not stopped to consider the fact that in 3,000 years of Jewish history, 3,000 years plus, the only thing that has exhibited continuity is adherence to the Torah. Nothing else has continuity. All the other groups of Jews who dedicated themselves to various other cultures, and there were many in Jewish history, all of them had died out. So trying to promote Jewish continuity with Jewish trips to the opera, and Jewish swim clubs, and Jewish Yom Kippur dances, and Jewish pork fries, and things like that, it's just not going to work. Here you have to make a choice. It's either or. So that's one way in which a person's choice of ultimate value, ultimate goal, can be criticized. It can be criticized on the grounds that it's an impossibility. It or jointly, several are impossibilities. Another is that he might be ignorant, now I'm coming to your case, he might be ignorant of another possibility. I have two quarreling children and one piece of cake. And I have to divide the cake between them. What is the best way to do it? Take a person whom they trust. Take a person whom they love. Someone whom they feel will want their best interests at heart. And that way they'll trust them. Maybe yes, and maybe no. If you have children, you'll see that it doesn't always work that way. But here's a clever way. Have one child cut the cake in half and have the other child choose which piece he wants. What's going to happen now? The first child is going to cut it exactly in half. And if he doesn't, and he gets a smaller piece, he has only himself to blame. Yeah, but everybody else. What a clever way for the parent to get out of this. Right? If the child's over 6 or 7, he can cut a piece of cake. That's a terrific solution. Right? Now, if you haven't thought of that solution, then you'll be content with the worst way of doing it. Okay, that's a bit of a joke. But there's a practical example in history. I'm told that in the 5 centuries before the French Revolution, the conditions in France were really horrible. People were starving, and they had no freedom, and they were subject to feudal lords who could control their lives without any restriction. For 5 centuries! Why then did the French Revolution take place in the 18th century? Why didn't it take place in the 15th century? Or the 14th century? One historian, I think this is the only thing I ever learned from my one course of history in university, Frank Manuel, who was a professor of mine at Brandeis, said, because the idea of a different social order didn't exist. To them, the feudal system was like the sun coming up in the morning. Let's say it's August in southern France. Is it hot? Yes. Does the sun give you sunburns? Yes. Are you opting for turning the sun off? Probably not. Because it will be much worse if the sun goes off. So you say, look, of course I want the sun to come up. That's the way it is. You know, without that, we have nothing. The feudal order was like that. There was no conceivable alternative. The minute you had philosophers who proposed a different alternative of how society could be organized, people already lost their allegiance to the feudal order, and then there was unrest, and eventually the revolution. So a person's values and priorities and goals can be limited by the fact that he just doesn't have enough information. He hasn't thought of alternatives. And one can criticize the person's choice of a value or a goal by saying, sure, that's what he's chosen. He's chosen it because he doesn't know any better. Just as we do with our 6-year-olds who want to become firemen. Okay, I know, that's how you feel at 6, but by the time you're 8, you'll figure out that's not where you belong. That's not really a good future for you. It's very glamorous now. Sirens, the bells ringing, you have everybody running out of the way. Boy, I'd like to be in that truck. Yeah, but yeah, you'll outgrow that. A final example. Here's George. George is 60. And he's chosen A as a very important value. His friend Peter is 21. Peter says to George, I know you've chosen A. I want you to know, you know, I went to the same school that you're going to. We grew up in the same neighborhood. When I was 16, I also chose A. But I'm 21 now. And at 21, I look back and I say that A was an immature choice. And I see now that A is really not appropriate. And I'm telling you that when you get to the age of 21, you'll see like I do, as I do, that it's a mistake. So, of course, George, being a red-blooded American boy, says, Peter, you know, get off the ship, and I'll live my own life, and he pursues A. And by the time he's 21, by golly, he does discover that A was shallow, and he changes his mind. Now, Moses repeats. At 21, he chooses B. Peter's now 26. And he says to George, yeah, I know you're choosing B, because you're 21. I was also 21. I went to the same college you're going to, so I know where you are, I know what you're feeling and experiencing. I'm telling you, when you get to 26, you'll see that be shot. And by golly, when George gets to 26, he rejects it just as Peter predicted. Now let's suppose it happens a third time, 26 and 31. And Peter says to George, you're choosing that because you're 26 and you're at this stage of life, but I'm 31, I know. And George gets to 31, and again, a third time, Peter is right. Comes to reject what he thought at 26. Now time number 4. George chooses D. Peter says, I know. You're 21. and you're 31, and you've chosen D, but I'm 36, and I've been there, and I qualified the same profession as you did, so I know exactly how you feel. But by the time you're 36, you're going to see that it's a shallow choice. Now let me ask you, does George have evidence at 31 that he's making a mistake? Peter's been right 3 times in a row. Seems to me, George could say, Peter seems to know me pretty well. He made 3 predictions about me, and he was right about me 3 times. That's pretty good insight. Now, he didn't do that by flipping a coin. He wouldn't have got that right 3 times in a row. And if he says the 4th time that I'm making a similar kind of mistake, that's evidence that he's right, that I'm making a mistake. Couldn't George then take advantage of what Peter says and skip 5 years? So listen, why should I wait for 5 years to find out that it was a shallow choice? I'll reject it now and look for something else, or I'll accept what Peter is saying. Here it seems to me, Peter has very good evidence that George is making a mistake. And George can adopt that evidence. He can adopt Peter's judgment and his accuracy and his predictions and say that Peter has given me reason to believe that my choices are wrong. It seems to me that we have plenty of examples of how a person's choice of ultimate values and ultimate priorities and the rest can be wrong. So it seems to me, therefore, that the idea of a conscience is a mistake, and the idea of each person being the last court of appeals for his own decisions of ultimate values and ultimate priorities is also a mistake. This is not the appropriate philosophy. And I think it makes a big difference, because many people preach, when you have a very difficult decision, just go off someplace and meditate and think about it until the inner answer bubbles up from inside and you sort of feel, yeah, that's it. That's what has to be. That's what I have to be. That's what it has to be. That's what I must do. And then, well, you've done it. You've done all that you can. And at that point, no one can criticize what you've done. And that's simply a terrible mistake. A terrible mistake.
But what choice do you
have? Oh, so what can you do in place of it?
You don't always have such a friend as Peter.
Well, one thing you could do is
always be right.
Correct. But
and
you
he doesn't know us as well as we do. You be honest about.
But this is one of the reasons that people read. Because when you read, you gain information vicariously about other people's experiences. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote an excruciating play called Les Mains Sales, Dirty Hands. This was a story during the Second World War of a young man whose mother was dying, and he was the only one who could attend her and help her, and who was instrumental to the French resistance against the Nazis, such as it was, before the French capitulated and cooperated with the Nazis, the brave, glorious French. And he had this choice of going out to the partisans and blowing up bridges and stopping the Nazi advance, but then abandoning his mother, which would accelerate her death and certainly her suffering, or staying with his mother and not giving his efforts to the war. Now, the point of the play, Les Mains Sales, the Dirty Hands, was whatever you do, you got dirty hands. There's no clean way out here. There's no way out without a feeling of guilt. There's no way out with a feeling that I've done the right thing perfectly. It's one of those awful, awful choices in life where whatever you do has a horrible cost. You could imagine a person never really being clear in his mind what the right choice was. Choosing and doing it, but always worrying that maybe the other choice would have been better. It's a very, very difficult situation. So now, when you read about that, it sensitizes you to values which you may never have thought of, because you were never in that circumstance. You read about the struggles of people and the consequences that they have. If you read philosophy, I mean, I'm not recommending that, kind of it, but if you actually read philosophy and see what people have written about moral choices and the kinds of dilemmas that they have come up with, I wrote a clever argument recently. People are pro-choice. Some of them have the following slogan: if you don't like abortions, don't have one. Leave the choice to those. If they don't like abortions, they have to have one. Isn't that the free, tolerant way to do things? Let everyone make his own choice of what he wants to do. That is crashingly stupid. Why? Because the anti-abortion position is that abortion is murder. Would you say to somebody, if you don't like murders, don't commit one? But don't have any prejudice against other people who do. Each person has his own values, you know. You don't commit murders and they do. Just leave them alone. No, we don't do that. If it really is murder, you stop it. And you stop it with force. So to say to the person who's against abortion, you know, if you don't like them, don't have one, is a complete misunderstanding of his position. Now, I mean, there are bumper stickers that read that. You know, if you don't like abortion, don't have one. The person who puts out such a bumper sticker is misled as to the logic of his position. And later, when he becomes better educated and a little more sophisticated, he'll look back and say, gosh, that was stupid. Why would, and he's lost a reason to take that kind of position. So I think reading novels and reading plays and reading biographies of people who struggled with real problems and reading real philosophy can help. It can give you a broader perspective. And then talking to people who strike you as insightful people. You don't have to wait for the guy to come to you and say, look, you're making a mistake. You can talk to people. Well, is this perfect? No, of course it's not perfect, but it can help. It can make the decision better based so that as you grow older and gather more experience, it's less subject to revision because you've invested in getting the relevant experience.
But isn't it in there?
Sorry?
Isn't in the end, this could be your own decision based on the information that you have.
Not
talking to people.
Yeah.
And your values, which are also based on, you know, discussions with Rabbi, Rabbi Torah, etc., etc. So, this conscience being your best friend and guide at each given time, it still works somehow.
No, I don't think it does. First of all,
I totally agree with this.
Yeah, no, let me spell that out a little more. The conscience is this inner voice. Mm-hmm. The inner voice that tells me this is right and this is wrong. Now, you can have a situation where the inner voice is loud and clear. It says A is right. Somebody else tells me A is wrong. And I think to myself, you know, the last three times in the argument between my inner voice and him, he was right. So I now judge that he's right over my inner voice. That doesn't change my inner voice. My inner voice still says A. But I'm deciding not to follow that inner voice. Knowing that somebody else doesn't change. It's like logic. Certain things seem logical to me. And I read in a book that they're not logical. If the book is a respectable book, an authoritative book, I may now judge it as illogical without knowing why. If you ask me what's logical, I'll say it's the first thing. But the book says no, so I will tell you the book is right without understanding why. My logical instincts are against the book, but I trust the book more than myself. That is not a case where the inner voice has changed. It's a case where I'm overriding the inner voice because I have reason to think the inner voice is making a mistake. Yeah.
So the inner voice is the same thing as one's logic, or are there different?
I'm giving it as another example. One's intuitive logic. And many people are under the conviction that if you flip a fair coin and get five heads in a row, it's now time for a tails. The next tails are not 50-50 anymore. And the odds now must be weighted in favor of the tails. So that I'd be willing to bet 6-4 on tails instead of 50-50. Right? Because five heads in a row. Many people's intuition tells them that's got to be right. Because, you know, it's a fair coin. Fair coin has to come up half the time heads and half the time tails. So if so, it came up five times in a row heads. We're due for some tails now. Now this is just a mistake. It's a complete mistake. It's called the gambler's fallacy. And if you like, I can explain to you in 2 minutes why it's a mistake. But it's a complete mistake. But casinos are making millions off of people who make this mistake because they don't know it's a mistake. The casino is very happy to take advantage of their mistake. So here, A person, let's say, reads this in a book, in a math book, and says, listen, this is a mistake. The odds are always 50-50, or, you bet on heads, because if you got five heads in a row, it's not really a fair coin. Maybe it's weighted in favor of heads. Right? But there's no reason whatsoever to bet in favor of tails. So, he reads that and he says, gosh, it doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem right. Look, you have five heads in a row. It's a fair coin. You've got to have some tails now. That's what it seems to me. But the book says no. And the book is written by a very famous authority on the subject. So when I go to the casino, I'm going to bet according to the book, even though my intuition still tells me it's got to be tails. That's exactly similar to the conscience. I haven't changed my intuition. My intuition still pushes me in that wrong direction. But I have the judgment to override my intuition. It's a little bit like, I'll give you another example, infatuation. Now imagine a guy who's been infatuated three times in the past, and all three times in the past, he realizes at the end there was a misjudgment and the girl was just using him, and he ended up broken by it afterwards. Now comes the fourth infatuation. So, he's stuck. You know, his heart is engaged. But his mind tells him, this is a stupid mistake. I've done this three times already. If he gets himself under control, he will cut it off, not because his heart feels any differently. His heart is still the same way it did before. But his mind now says, my heart's making a mistake. That's what I'm talking about, where the inner voice, the inner feeling, the inner intuition remains the same, and the mind can make the judgment that it's a mistake and sometimes take control. That's not the same as changing the inner voice. So when I say that you have to, as he points out, in the end you'll have to make your decision. That doesn't mean that you're going back to the inner voice. The decision can be to reject the inner voice. That's what I'm pointing
out. Or integrating.
Or integrating. The point is, it's not infallible. You no longer just look inside and follow what it says.
Exactly.
That policy is incorrect. Yeah.
I don't know. You may come to it, but where's the relation to the soul?
Let's talk about the Yetzer Tov and the soul for a moment. Why about that? Of course, that's the next question. Didn't God create us with a Yetzer Tov, a good inclination, which is an expression of the soul, and that good inclination surely is always right? That's correct. He did. And it is. And it doesn't contradict what I said. Because one property of the inner voice is that you can recognize it. Can recognize who's talking. The idea of the conscience that is an inner voice whispering in your ear, and it wears the big C. See, I'm conscious. Don't confuse me with anybody else. I think our view is that the Yetzer Tov is there, the good inclination is there, and it never makes a mistake, but it can be muffled, covered up, or distorted so that you can't hear it correctly, or other voices get mistaken for it. There's a fascinating midrash. The midrash says that when Jacob wrestled with the angel, part of the time the angel looked like a robber, and part of the time the angel looked like a Talmid Chacham, a Torah scholar. The angel, according to our sources, is the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, the Satan. What's the idea that part of the time it looked like a robber, and part of the time it looked like as a Torah scholar? And here's the idea, I think, at least in simple terms. Part of the time, the Yetzer Hara says, cheeseburgers, bacon, cheeseburgers, 2-for-1 sale at McDonald's this week. Wait till next week, gentlemen, you'll keep kosher next week. But this week, don't miss it, 2-for-1. Okay? He just blandishes a pure, clear Aveira and says, go for it. Sometimes the Yetzer Hara comes along and says, you should do A, because A is a mitzvah. And he pulls out the Shulchan Aruch, and he shows you that it is a mitzvah. It says right there in the Shulchan Aruch that it's a mitzvah. What interest would the Yetzer Hara have in inducing you to do a mitzvah? The answer is, although it is a mitzvah, it's not right under these conditions. Well, he doesn't tell you that. And therefore, he's fooling you. He's fooling you into thinking that it's a mitzvah. That's a different kind of Yetzer Hara. It's a different kind of attack. Here he's putting on the conscience costume. He's putting on the Yetzer Tov costume. He's saying, I'm the Yetzer Tov. I'm telling you what, that it's a mitzvah to do it. And then you need very special techniques to analyze whether it is or isn't. We had a boy here a long time ago, about 18 years ago. He came from a right-wing conservative family in America. And he told me he had a terrible dilemma. His parents wanted him to come home for Rosh Hashanah. So he said, I wrote out a list of 10 requirements for me to come home for Rosh Hashanah, 10 halakhic requirements. And my parents refused to agree to them. So what can I do? How can I explain to them that I shouldn't come home for Rosh Hashanah? So I said, that's interesting. Show me the letter. Show me the 10 requirements that you laid down. Well, to make a long story short, all 10 were incorrect. They were all incorrect in halakha. This boy studying in the Hegel Arsamath, the great Arsamath, he made it up. He simply made it up. He drew conclusions and compared one thing to another thing, and all 10 were wrong. I said to him, you are a fool. Why didn't you go to one of the teachers and ask? You invented this on your own. You're a beginning student. Look what a miscommunication you created with your parents. They were right and you were wrong. So here, what's really pushing him was, well, I can wave this at my parents and I can say no to them and I can prove to them how independent I am. And that led him to make the elementary mistake of not checking with a scholar whether the requirements were correct or incorrect. So there is the Yetzer Hara coming to him with the Shulchan Aruch and saying, which Shulchan Aruch? No, the Shulchan Aruch with a little infantile logic which gets you infantile conclusions. So this is the really the problem. The problem is that you can't always identify which voice in you is the Yetzer Tov voice. So even though it is there, and that's why looking inside is not the right way. Yeah.
So the conscience really is completely made up of the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. It's like just everything. It's not just the Yetzer Tov speaking.
Okay, so at this point, if you describe it that way, then I think the word conscience has to be sacrificed. Because the word conscience is tied to the idea that it's morally infallible. That it can't be criticized. That it ends the discussion. Once you give that up, there's no reason to use the word anymore. Yeah.
May I reflect on what you said?
Yeah.
The way I see it, the way how we can best make our decision should really be around three major things, which are values, information, and inner voice. Inner voice can have many sides. You're absolutely right. If we are lazy, we are not going to be comfortable to do sport, and that would be a part of inner voice. That's not. But at the same time, there might be a message to us that we really have to engage in sports. For example, we might have quite a few things. So if we can acquire our values from the Torah, and we can get our information from reading the books, from consulting with knowledgeable people, etc., can our vibrant information help us pick up the true inner voice?
I think that's close to the truth. I think it is close to the truth. Let me.
Because we want to be in touch with our feelings,
yeah,
which is probably our,
yeah,
soul.
I think this is right, but it has to be handled very delicately. Let me give you an example in an area that's a little easier to deal with, a little easier to understand. It's not so controversial or crucial. Let's take intuition. People have intuitions about things. You ask the person, why do you feel that way? I don't know. That's just the way I feel about it. He hasn't had any reason. No proof, no evidence. He just looks at the situation and says, that's the way I feel about it. For many people, when you say that, it sounds like it's totally irrational. You have no reasons. You have no evidence. You didn't do any statistics. As we'll see in a minute, maybe that's quite right. So, that's the way you feel about it? So what? That's just your subjectivity. Who says it has any value? But there's a way to use it, and to use it with reason and with justification. Let's take psychological intuition. You look at a person, doesn't look happy. What's his problem? Is he depressed? Is he anxious? Is he have low self-esteem? Is he suffering from an overhang? What makes him that way? Some people will tell you, I'll tell you what it is, 80% anxiety with 20% depression. That's what's bothering him. I tell you. I look at him, I look at his body posture. That's what's going on. How do you know that? I just have this insight into people. The crucial question would be to ask him, did you ever check? That's the way to look to him. Did you ever check? Go over to him, talk to him, ask him about how he feels. Try to interact with him to help him and see whether your interaction helps or doesn't help. Now suppose he says, yes, as a matter of fact, I've checked often. And indeed, almost always I'm right. Now, that means he's checked his intuition, what we call empirically. He's checked it by experience. He needs his intuition. Another person without the intuition wouldn't have anything to check. The intuition plays a crucial role. I'm not throwing away the intuition in favor of evidence. What I have is evidence that the intuition is correct. Then it's worthwhile to check, to trust those intuitions. Mathematics, you have people who have intuitions which way to go. Is that kind of problem? So try a Fourier series, or try irrational numbers, or try multidimensional analysis, or try some. How do you know? I don't. That's what my intuition tells me. Why? Because this guy proves theorems every year. This guy solves problems every year. So he knows that his intuitions are trustworthy because they lead to good results. Still, if you ask him, when he has this intuition, why? What's the basis of it? What's the evidence for it? His answer is, I don't know, it just seems to be that way. But I have evidence that when it seems to be that way, that's the way it is. So that's evidence to trust the intuition, which isn't based on evidence. That, I think, is good. Sometimes, a person without an inner voice, when he faces a situation, must have a blank. I don't know. I'm overwhelmed by the situation. Having an inner voice is very important, but it's got to be checked by external sources. That's the crucial thing. It has to be checked by internal. If it is checked and it turns out to be reliable, then it could gain reason to be followed. And here, I think it may be reliable in some areas and not in others. This is also very tricky. How I should proceed with my personal self-development is one type of question. How I should interact with other people is another type of question. What we should do politically is another type of question. A person might have good moral intuition for one and not for the other. So everything depends ultimately on its being certified by experience. But when it's certified by experience, then I think it is very useful. Correct. And this is true with intuition altogether. In some quarters, the word intuition is used as a put-down. You know, oh, that's only intuition. I think that's a mistake. If the intuition can be shown to be generally reliable, then intuition is a source of knowledge, a source of valid information about the world.
In the end, intuition becomes a synthesis of our private information.
If you are careful to have the external check, that's the crucial thing. Okay. Now, I hope you appreciate that this tilts in the direction of absolute values. Many people think that values are surely only subjective, surely only relative, which are not the same thing, and indeed relative is absolute. I probably won't go into that thing. But these are only subjective. If a person's values can be criticized, then they aren't purely subjective. They aren't purely subjective. And I've given you a number of different ways in which a person's values can be criticized. So, people who think that values are subjective have to think again. Maybe I will say just a word about relative versus absolute. People who think of relative values say things like this. Well, A is right for me, but it might not be right for you. Okay, let's take them at their word. A is right for me, but not for you. Is A really right for me? And B really right for you? Really? Absolutely? Absolutely really right for me? Could we say A is right for you, but A is not right for you, for me. For me, A is not right for you. Can we say that? That's not right, right? The whole point of relative values is, I get to say for me what's right for me, period, and nobody can. But then, I guess, if it's relative to me, then it really is right for me. Then, that's an absolute statement about values. Relativity isn't the opposite of absolutes. Relativity just tells you how you have to go about making an absolute statement. To make an absolute statement, you've got to tell me what it's relative to. John is taller. Isn't he? Is he? Or is he not? Taller? Don't be silly. Taller than what? Taller is relative. Okay, John is taller than Peter. That surely is true or false. Absolutely. Once I fill in John and Peter, it becomes absolute. Relativity isn't the opposite of absolute. Relativity just tells you what you've got to do to become absolute. Einstein's theory of relativity was a great success in creating absolute statements. That's what it was. It wasn't the declaration that everything is relative and there's nothing, no such thing as absolute. On the contrary, he searched for a way of making absolute statements. What he said is certain concepts are relative, so I have to move to something else which makes absolute statements. So relative values simply become absolute when you fill in what it's relative to. Now, what will it mean to say that A is right for me? So it doesn't mean that I said it. And if I say the opposite, it becomes the opposite. We're not talking about what words you pronounce. A is right for me means something like it does the best for me, it increases something that's good for me, it satisfies my desires or brings me pleasure or something like that. Right? If so, then a person could make a mistake about what is right for him. So making it relative doesn't even make it subjective in the sense that if I say it, it's got to be right. No. It's sort of like therapy. You need different therapy for different diseases. So, if A and B are different people, you could say X is the right therapy for A, and Y is the right therapy for B. Different therapies are needed for different people in different conditions. Quite correct. But then X being the right therapy for A is an absolutely true statement. And it's true whether A recognizes it or not. So talking about relative values doesn't avoid absolute, and it doesn't avoid the possibility of making a mistake. It doesn't make things subjective. Relative just says that rules have to be tailor-made to individual circumstances. And the truth is that once you say it that way, it's obvious that every system is relative in that sense. No system says that all people have to follow exactly the same rules. Unless the rules have built into them, if you're a father, then it works this way, and if you're a child, it works that way, and if you have an income over this amount, it works that way, and if you live in the suburbs, it works that way, and if you've already been wounded in a foreign war of the country, maybe you don't have to go into the army. All those conditions have to be built in. Nobody thinks the same rules apply exactly to everybody. So what's right for one person may definitely be not right for another person. That says nothing about whether it's absolute. It says nothing about it. Here, relative is just the opposite of universal. Yeah, it's relative. It's not the same for everybody. It could vary with conditions. It can still be that it's absolutely correct for the individual, and that the individual alone is not the court of appeals to decide what is relatively right for them. Okay. It's a tough world. All right. That's right.